our title slide. This evening's quite unrelated to the lesson, but there is an enormous quarry, a rock quarry, that begins right at the northern wall of the old city of Jerusalem and extends for, I think it's close to half a mile underneath the city, and then branches out from this main line, you know, in many directions. It's been called Solomon's Quarry. It's been called Zedekiah's Cave, but for millenniums, it has been the location for the rock that built Jerusalem. Particularly Herod used it the most for the Temple Mount and all of his work there in creating that fabulous Temple Mount area 2,000 plus years ago. Quite unrelated to all of that are two things. Number one, this morning, of course, we mentioned that I was able to get an address where you could mail relief and help for the saints in Paradise. This is the Paradise fire from five or six days ago. Somewhere in the midst of that awful conflagration lies the entirety of this little city of Paradise there, 27,000 people. This is the address where if you'd like to write a check and mail it, you can use to help those folks out. I mentioned this morning 80,000. I really got my mouth tangled up this evening. 80% of the members of the church there lost their homes. What that means is that there are only three families who did not. So the entire church, but for three families, lost all of their homes in this. Now, I was mentioning somebody earlier, but you can see how difficult the terrain is. It's not like you can have freeways crisscrossing everything. The fire was burning at 30 miles an hour. The traffic jam in the evacuation was moving at 4. So you can understand why it was that there wasn't anything anybody could do. But when the fire lit, immediately it took off at 30 miles an hour. By the time anybody could get an evacuation order out, as soon as people hit the roads, stop and go 4 miles an hour with a 30-mile fire coming at you from three sides. So if you can, and you'd like to give the folks some help there, now that's the address. Joe Glenn, the care of Joe Glenn, is the preacher for Paradise. He lost his home. He lost the church building, of course. Both were insured. We trust everybody else's homes were insured. But he will be handling all of that since the congregation does not have elders. I would like, go ahead. Linda.
When you make the check out, do you make it to Joe Glenn?
No, you make it out to the Chico Church of Christ, care of Joe Glenn. Okay, on the check. But note on the check that it is for Paradise Fire victims. It's an excellent question, really glad you asked. Write a check to the Chico Church so they can cash it. The bank accounts that's set up, in their name. But it's for Paradise Fire victims. As long as you have that much data, on it, you'll be okay, both with the address and for the check. Just make sure you earmark it for the Paradise Church, yes?
Well, the church building is self-destroyed.
Yeah, completely.
Is any of this going to go to rebuild that?
It was insured, but decisions have to be made. It is scattered far and wide whether or not the people are going to return, how long it'll take, it's unknown. So we'll see if the church ever comes back. But at this point, we're just trying to help. All we're trying to do with the money that's being collected right now is to get people through this first month. In the first month, they will not be able to even go back to see that they lost everything. They know they have, but they can't even get there. So they're living in hotels an hour and a half away. They still have jobs, most of them down in the Chico area. But, that's all the problem. So it's just an immense disaster, and nobody's faced anything quite like it since San Francisco, I guess, Chicago. And so they just got totally started over. So I would like to read this into the tape, though, for those. We have a fair number of people who listen to recordings throughout the week and immediately, they keep up. And so you make a check out to the Chico Church of Christ. Chico Church of Christ. But if somewhere on the check you'll designate it's care of Joe Glenn for Paradise Fire victims. If you put Joe Glenn or you put Paradise Fire, you know, any of those terms, they'll know, okay, it goes in this account and not that one. It'll be used exclusively for those people. And then as addressed, mail it to 995 East Lassen, that's Lassen Avenue, in Chico, California, at 95973. I'll send out an email as well for everybody, but I had so much interest this afternoon, people sending emails, thank you all. I knew you'd want to have it. I had several people ask me as I came in the building, so you know, get it up here for you right now, but I'll send everybody an email with this as well. So Chico Church of Christ, care of Joe Glenn, and for the Paradise Fire victims, 995 East Lassen Avenue, Chico, California, 95973. Okay, so what we're now going to do is turn our attention to what is certainly the last of the parables of Christ. Tonight we're going to look at a couple parables, both of which will be found in Matthew chapter 25. A moment ago, Bill read a portion of these first 13 verses, which of course is typically referred to as the wise and foolish virgins. So the parable of this group of 10 young women, five of whom were wise, five of whom were foolish, is one of the more famous, better known of the parables. And so, you know, really the main message lies quite completely on the surface. However, while this will certainly be the end of the parables, we'll find out in a minute how well I can do and how I just feel about it, I guess. We might end really early or maybe a little bit late. But there will be more information in Matthew chapter 25 that is not a parable, but which is directly related. So I thought tonight, and if not tonight, certainly next week, we will look at the entirety of Matthew chapter 25. So to begin, and because it is so familiar, in the first 13 verses of Matthew 25, I would like first just to point out, please note, the chapter has absolutely no break in the train of thought. In the context, there is no interruption or change of subject in any way, shape, or form. Whatever's going on in the preceding verses is continued by the word, then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. That then, directly, unequivocally, it's impossible to see it any other way, ties the preceding information together. Jesus spoke these words without interruption. The chapter break is a convenience for us to locate things, but it also can be seriously misleading because it just naturally tends to have us divorce this parable from its context and the reason why Jesus spoke these words. These words were spoken because of what he had been saying in chapter 24. So let's go back into chapter 24, make certain we understand the context of the parable if we were to have any hope of understanding its immediate and focused meaning at the time Jesus presented it. We're just going to start right here with verse 27 in Matthew 24. Just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. The topic of Matthew chapter 24 is the coming of the Son of Man. That is the only topic in Matthew chapter 24. It was introduced in verse 3. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming?" They recognized when Jesus came, it would be the end of the age. That is the end of the Mosaic age, the end of the Mosaic covenant. If the temple is going to burn, if not one stone will be left upon another, we cannot practice the Jewish religion. The old covenant is dead in the water. So they're asking about the sign for this coming, a time when this will take place. And they're being told throughout all of this what, as you saw in verse 27, the coming of the Son of Man will be. In verse 27, what it's going to be like is like lightning. In other words, nobody's going to miss it. When the coming of the Son of Man comes, you people I'm talking to, you're going to know it. Now, in Thessalonica, they were an awful long way away. They were nowhere near Jerusalem, the immediate circumstances, so they weren't going to see it. But the people that are Jesus is addressing here in the Mount of Olives, looking down at the temple, pointing at it, as the context says, you know, they would. So it's not going to be mistakable. Lightning flash goes off. Everybody knows it. skip on down to verse 30. Then the sign, that's what they ask about in verse 3, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. Please note, every Greek scholar will tell you there's two ways to translate that first part of that verse. Two ways. Most people, growing up in denominational churches, who become translators, because virtually all translators, Jack Lewis being a big exception, you know, are not members of the Lord's church. They're in denominational churches. They are therefore carrying with them their ideas about eschatology, their ideas about the coming of the man into the translation. So when they have to make a decision between two ways to translate it, denominational people will pick the one way that best supports what they already believe. They're not going to pick a translation that the Greek allows, but which they don't understand. Doesn't make sense to them, so they pick the other way. Most translations then have the idea in verse 30 that the sign's going to be up there. That the sign is going to be, in the sky. It's not. What we're seeing is that a sign will come that proves, that demonstrates that the Son of Man is in heaven. He's not in Hades. He was only there for 3 days. He's not dead. He's eternally living. And he's ruling from a throne in heaven. So the sign, the Son of Man is in heaven, will appear. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. We've done this many times in the last 6.5 years. This is the verbiage of Isaiah 13 and many other passages. Whether you understand what it means or not, the Jews did because they understood their Old Testament. And even if you don't understand what the words mean, they mean the invasion of an army on the earth, you will know when you read verse 34, the when. So whatever you think those words mean, he says in verse 34, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. It's a simple statement. All these things will take place in this generation. Now look at verse 36. But of the day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man. That's the only topic under consideration. There's been no switch in midstream of horses. We're only talking about the questions they asked. And these are first century questions to be fulfilled in that generation. So you'll know the time frame, but not the day or the hour. 37, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. How will they be like the days of Noah? It'll be like the days of Noah, according to verse 39. They did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So, in that manner, in this way, the coming of the Son of Man will also be. Not everybody, those that don't listen to Jesus or don't believe Jesus, is going to recognize that we're in the time frame and that we need to flee the city, as he told them earlier. So they didn't understand until the flood was upon them and then took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Skip to 42. I know it's all intriguing. A lot of denominational teaching has influenced us as well. These are future events. They're not. All the phrasing I've shown you in previous classes dealing with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And I've done that in other classes. In 42, we're just getting the context. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day the Lord is coming. Look at 44. For this reason, you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think. Look at verse 50. The master of that slave, and now we're in the parables we dealt with last week, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect, and at an hour which he does not know. They have been told in verse 34 that the Son of Man will come. All these things will take place in their generation, during their lifetime. They are told in 36 they won't know the day and the hour. They are told in 39 they won't understand until the flood comes, those that are disbelievers. In 42, you don't know the day when your Lord is coming. And then in 44, you don't know an hour. It's an hour when you don't think. And then in 50, he'll come on a day when he doesn't expect and in an hour which he does not know. Is it hard to understand that if you tell a people, these will all take place in your generation. But you won't know the day and the hour. You won't know the day and the hour until it actually happens. You won't know the day and the hour. It's in your generation. But you won't know the day or the hour until it comes down. So I'm not going to give you the day or the hour. I'm only going to give you the generational parameters. And then you won't know the day. You won't know the hour. You won't know the day. You won't know the hour. You won't know the day. You won't know the hour. So in 50, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect, at an hour which he does not know, and shall cut him in pieces, assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there, and the gnashing of teeth. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 were foolish. 5 were prudent. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the prudent took oil in flasks along with their lamps. While the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight there was a shout, "Behold, the bridegroom come out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose, trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the prudent, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the prudent answered, saying, "No, there will not be enough for us and for you too. Go instead to the dealers, buy some for yourselves." While they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. Later the other virgins also came, saying, "Lord, Lord, open up for us." But he answered and said, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour." Where did the subject change from the fall of Jerusalem when they were pointing at the temple? Jesus said, "You'll see a time when not one stone will be left on another. What's the sign? When, Lord? I tell you, in this generation, but you won't know the day or the hour. 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 And you won't know the day or the hour. Let me tell you a parable about these 10 virgins. And you won't know the day or the hour." Now Jesus, what he's done, without ever taking a breath, chapter headings, incidental and inconsequential, it does not affect the context, is he is telling those people, in your generation, you better be all ready, because it's going to happen in your lifetime. But then, the day or the hour, you're not going to know till that flood comes. And at that moment, he's taught them in the preceding verses of chapter 24, flee the city, go to the Judean hills. Okay? So, this is the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. Is it true that we don't know the day or the hour when the Lord will descend through the clouds, like in Acts 1 he left, and there will be a resurrection of both the evil and the good in John 5, so that those who are alive and remain will be caught up together with the Lord in the air, after the dead in Christ rise first? Are all those things still true? Yes. Is there one word about them in Matthew 25, 1 through 13? No. That is not what Jesus is talking about. Nobody asked that question. Jesus isn't answering that question. They have very specific question. Jesus has very specific answers and an incontrovertible time frame. It'll all happen in this generation, but you won't know the day or the hour. So when that day or hour comes, be ready. And don't be foolish. Because there won't be time then. Okay? No change in thought. The parable of the wise and foolish virgins is about the fall of Jerusalem and Jesus preparing those people to be ready for the day and the hour. Now, my Bible, what I've done is, I highlighted in yellow every one of these time references. You don't know the day or the hour, you don't know the day and the hour. So it's real easy for me now. I believe this for 30 years, but now when I go back and I look at this, it just leaps right off the page. There is no break in thought. We're talking about the fall of Jerusalem and their generation. So, true, you need to be ready. Don't be foolish. Live your life that way. Someday the Lord Jesus will come back through the clouds. But these verses are not talking about that. 1 Thessalonians 4 is, Acts chapter 1 does, all of 1 Corinthians 15, but not the first 13 verses of Matthew 25. So the question becomes, did Jesus change the subject and leap two millenniums into the future with verse 14? Do you see a transition? Did Jesus say, now let me tell you about something else? Oh, I'd also like for you to know about an event that's 2,000 years away, will not be in this generation. Does Jesus do anything like that in 25:14? For it is just like a man about to go on a journey, who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. Immediately, the one who had received the 5 talents went, traded with them, gained 5 more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more, but he who received the 1 went away and dug in the ground, hid his master's money. Now, after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up, brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I've gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. The one also who had the 2 talents came up, said, Master, you entrusted to me 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed, and I was afraid. Went away, hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked slave, wicked, lazy slave. You knew that I reap where I did not sow, gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival, I would have received back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him. Give it to the other one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, shall more be given. He shall have an abundance. From the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. And cast out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, all terminology he used in Matthew 24 prior to verse 34, when he said all these things will take place in this generation, Jesus uses the same terminology that was followed just a few verses later in Matthew 24 with the declaration it would happen to that generation. In 31 of chapter 25, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, all the angels with him, he'll sit on his glorious throne, all the nations will be gathered before him, he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, he'll put the sheep on his right, the goats on his left, and uh-oh, did a transition take place? Did the topic change? Did Jesus shift his gaze from this generation to one that is 2,000 years in the future? No. Absolutely not. In any way, shape, or form did Jesus change the subject when he began to speak at chapter 25 and verse 31. He just said, but when the Son of Man comes, which is the only thing we've been talking about since the apostles asked the question on the Mount of Olives in chapter 24 in verse 3, which goes back to Jesus' statement in 24:2. Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down. The fall of Jerusalem is absolutely, unequivocally, very certainly, I think indisputably, the only topic in chapters 24 and 25. This parable in verses 14 through 30, we've already seen in a previous class. It's identical to a passage in Luke we studied a couple weeks ago. Jesus is preaching this message throughout his 3.5 years. This passage, then, we're not going to talk about tonight. I've already done it just a couple of weeks ago. So you know this parable, because we've already seen it in this class back in Luke. Okay? What is Jesus talking about? What is the parable of the talents about? You don't know when the master's coming home. And what should you do until he does? Be busy doing his business. So don't be surprised when he shows up. Have your profit ready for presentation. Be ready, because you're not going to know the day and the hour, brethren, is exactly what this parable is all about. Trade with this and be productive until I come. Until I come. Verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in His glory. So, the 31st verse begins to the end of the chapter, a section that is not a parable. It's not a parable. But it is simultaneously the declarative sentence about what this parable is talking about. Verse 31. You, in 31, want to be ready, so that when the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, and He sits on this throne and this judgment scene takes place, and sheep are separated from goats, you're going to be what? Sheep. He tells those people in that generation when these events are going to take place, every single one of them. So what I'd like to do for the next few minutes is to now move into this passage, 31 through 46, which is not parable. It is straight up declaration. But in the declaration, it is directly linked to the preceding parables. So the talents and the virgins is about not knowing the day or the hour in preparation for, you know, a judgment. The bridegroom comes. The Son of Man comes in His glory. Here, that is the farthest back probably I've ever shown you, an aerial shot of Jerusalem. If you look carefully, you can kind of see it. There's a long wall right here, and then you can see the street going up right to there and across here and around like this. That is old Jerusalem. These walls have been standing since the time of Christ. Our discussion about the judgment scene in Matthew 25 is about that city in that generation. Now, let me show you how that works, knowing that the first time you look at this, you know, because we've been raised in a culture which for an awful long time has been dominated by denominational thought, we in the church have also, many people come to believe, well, it's talking about the end of the world, because after all, that's what the denominational people say. We can't think of another way it could fit, so we think that too. We agree with them on that. Brother, it's just wrong. What you have to do, and I'm imploring you to do this, is I would like for you to go home and for the rest of this week, read that 25th chapter over and over and over again. Best, read both 24 and 25. But think very carefully. I've spent hours at it. Where does Jesus change the subject from the questions asked? There's two questions in verse 3. When and what's the sign of your coming? Which ends the age. Jewish age. This generation. Read those two chapters over and over and over and over again. I've done my time with them. You do yours. Okay? Where's the transition? Where do we jump two millenniums to a future judgment that is no longer local, that is no longer their generation, that is far, far away in the distance, and that becomes global? It is the end of the world. Now, these are extremely disparate concepts. Where did Jesus do that? Now, brother, for years I believed that He did. And then as the years went by, I kept changing my mind on where He did it. Until I realized the reason why I had such a hard time figuring out where He changed it was because I was assuming that He had. And then, you know, it just wouldn't fit. I wrestled with it for years. and finally realized, well, you know, the obvious solution here is he didn't change the subject. Under figures of speech, under expressions that are known to Jews from their Old Testament writings, Jesus reveals things that are more difficult for us to understand because we haven't been Old Testament Jews. So the verbiage is unfamiliar to us. We then take it and push it into the future and make it global instead of local. That's not what happened. So with that introduction, and I will finish this tonight. I think I've got just enough time to do it. I'm just planting this seed for you now. And if this isn't, you know, if this is your first time, fine. Maybe it's not. But find the transition. When you do, call me and tell me where it is that Jesus changed the subject from a local judgment on the Jewish people in Jerusalem in the first century, that generation, to a judgment that will be local no more, that will be Jewish no more, that will be in that generation no more. Now we're going to talk about the end of the world. Where did he do it? I'd love for you to find out for me. That's why, you know, be easier, I suppose. But here's what he actually said. I think in terminology they understood to be referring to the exact same event that they asked about. Verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, He'll sit on His glorious throne. All the nations, I know it says all the nations, will be gathered before Him. He'll separate them from one another as a shepherd separates sheep from goats. He'll put sheep on His right, goats on the left. Then the King will say to those on His right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. What kingdom did the Jews want? Jesus, is it time for you to restore the kingdom, they asked. Not for you to know the time of the hour, just do your job. But they understood those prophets, and yes, the kingdom came that had been so long prophesied in their generation. They lived to be a part of that kingdom. The king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. That kingdom is the church on earth at that time. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. Sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. The righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when do we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When do we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? When do we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent you did it to one of these, please pick up the thread. What is the criteria for the judgment? What separates sheep from goats? What is the absolutely only criteria for the judgment that's being discussed here? 40. The king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even to the least of them, you did it to me. Then he'll also say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you did not invite me in. Naked, you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, you did not visit me. Then they themselves also will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, a stranger, naked or sick or in prison, and did not take care of you? And then he'll answer them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now, when the judgment's over, goats are in eternal punishment. Sheep have inherited the kingdom that had been prophesied since the beginning. What judgment are we talking about? It has to be the fall of Jerusalem. Here's why I think I know this for sure now. It took me years to find it. I asked myself, what is the standard of judgment? What is the only question that must be asked to decide if you live or die, if you're in the kingdom or not? There is only one thing. How did you treat the brothers of the Lord? Jerusalem fell. The Jews were destroyed as a nation, never to rise again. They're a political entity that has nothing to do with descendancy from Abraham today, because they have not been God's chosen people for 2,000 years. And that kingdom ended, the kingdom of the Jews, the old Jewish covenant, that ended based entirely on whether or not you became brother to the Lord Jesus Christ, your Messiah, and treated Christians properly. If you treated Christians properly, then you're sheep. If you mistreated Christians, then you are goats headed for eternal fire. So, brethren, I know for years I believed it myself. Jesus got out in the middle of the river and he changed the topic. Got on a different horse 2,000 years in the future to talk about the end of the world too. I deny this. I deny this with all my heart. I deny this after years and years of study. I deny this because it's just not true. This passage, Matthew 24, is unmistakable. Chapter 25 is glued to it like the pieces of the tie I told you about this morning. Okay? That's what we're talking about. So, this may raise some questions for some of you. It always does, you know, but that's fine. You'll be happy to entertain you. There's a whole lot more. There are various books, you know, and recordings that I can direct you to. But there it is. Brother, my absolute conviction, I mean, unequivocally now for 30 years, I guess, is this. Jesus never changed the subject. You don't know the day or the hour, but you better be ready. In this generation, be sheep or be goats. But you don't know the day or the hour. Every single thing he says after the statement, these things, all these things will take place in this generation, is about that generation. Not knowing the day or the hour, but knowing it's in your lifetime. Be ready for the judgment that is based on how did you treat Christians. Not on righteousness, not on whether or not you're a faithful, you know, Christian. The future judgment, brethren, will be based on a different set of criteria. Whether or not you are a Christian, personally, is the final judgment. Whether or not you're treating the saints right is what's about this judgment. And it was the Jews that weren't treating the saints right in Matthew 24 and 25. So, with all of that, as I'm suggesting, limited to this city, the immediate terrain you see in that aerial photograph of Jerusalem, let us work, brethren, because of the passages that are directed at us. This says, the night is coming, Jesus was going to leave. Let's be busy in that kingdom. We can help you do so. Please come forward, speak with me as we stand. Come forward, speak with me as we stand. Come forward.